You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. A new administration in Washington will be taking office in just a few weeks with Donald Trump as president and Mike Pence, now soon to be former governor of Indiana, as vice president. Let's check and see what has been talked about so far, the appointments that have been proposed to run the Environmental Protection Agency and other environmental agencies that will impact Indiana. And for that, we turn to the executive director of the Sierra Club of Indiana, Bowden Quinn. Bowden, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Well, first, give us an overview from what you all at the Sierra Club in Indiana see it as the impact that we're going to see in the change of administration in Washington. And
certainly, we expect we're in for a struggle over the next few years. I think perhaps the largest concern will be defunding the regulatory agencies like the EPA, and we won't be able to count on their support as much as we have in the past to enforce federal laws. And then we'll have to see what actually happens with those laws and whether they are weakened.
One of the concerns I know on a national level, and the executive director nationally of the Sierra Club, Michael Brune, has mentioned that he's concerned that everything that the Obama administration has done, the progress it has made, and protecting public lands might possibly be overturned. Is that a concern in Indiana, as you folks see it, or just go along with the national people and say this is going to be a problem?
Well, it's certainly something that we'll want to look at. It may be more of a problem out west than here in Indiana. But again, lack of funding could cause a problem so that even the lands that we have could deteriorate without the proper funding for maintenance and operations. So that certainly is one concern. But on a hopeful note, we've just seen that there's bipartisan support for permanently renewing the Land and Water Conservation Fund, mm-hmm. which provides money for purchasing additional federal land in holdings, things like that. So we're not completely pessimistic.
We've had a chance here, at least in a few weeks, to have heard more from the soon-to-be our new Indiana governor, Eric Holcomb, on how he feels about Indiana environmental issues and the like here. Are you heartened or concerned, as I'm sure other environmental leaders and organizations might be, about what's going to happen here in Indiana?
Well, we're taking an open mind. We certainly want to try to work with the new governor and find areas of agreement and in those areas that we don't agree, we hope for a decent exchange of views, and we'll see how things turn out.
As looking ahead to the legislative session that gets underway here on January 3rd in Indianapolis, is there anything that the Sierra Club of Indiana is concerned about, is going to keep a close eye on as Hoosier lawmakers come back into session, this being the longer session where they're dealing with a two-year state government budget?
Well, certainly the budget is one thing we'll be looking very closely at. Is there going to be adequate funding for the Department of Environmental Management and the Department of Natural Resources and our Land Conservation Fund? And then we are expecting continued threats, as we've had in the past, to the ability for people to put solar panels on their roof and the promotion of distributed energy, which provides the best opportunity to increase clean and sustainable energy around the state.
And I'm probably sure that your concerns, as far as the Sierra Club's concerned about making sure that the DNR gets the proper funding, probably extends as well, too, to concerns, make sure that the Hoosier forests aren't being taken down and used for profit as well, too, to continue to keep an eye on those.
Certainly, the increase in logging over the past, actually 8 years or more, has been a big concern, especially in the last four. There's been dramatic increases, and that is something that we will again take to the legislature and try to get bipartisan agreement that there needs to be more protection for our state forests.
Is there anything in particular that the Sierra Club of Indiana is going to be doing? Any campaigns they're going to be working on going into 2017?
Well, we're going to wait to see what comes up in the legislature. But yes, the forest protection bill will certainly be a high priority. We're hoping to work with Senator Charbonneau and others on some kind of water legislation to find equitable funding to make the huge investments in our water infrastructure that we know will be needed over the next few years.
And I'm imagining, too, that that Senator Charbonneau is going to probably extend some assistance as well to some of his colleagues in both sides of the aisle, I guess, and not only the Senate, but also in the Indiana House, to make sure that that infrastructure work is done, or at least the start of the spending is done to help keep it up.
Yes, he's been a great leader on this issue for the last few years, really making sure that everybody understands the problem, getting all the facts, and moving deliberately. And so we're hopeful he will be able to garner bipartisan support for a good bill to move us on down the road.
We've been talking with Bowden Quinn, who is the executive director of the Sierra Club in Indiana, looking ahead to what the change of administration in the White House in Washington will bring, as well as look at the change of administration at the Indiana State House as well, with a new governor and the start of the legislative session coming up, too. Bowden, thank you very much for being with us to give us an update, and we'll help check back with you here during the session if there are any big problems that pop up, and especially, too, as we just mentioned here about Senator Ed Charbonneau's work on trying to help improve infrastructure across the state and the efforts to come up with the funds to be able to at least to start the work on. That's going to be a very, very big and probably a very, unfortunately, very long-going project, I imagine. Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Let's take a look at the Indiana economy and look at this past year, as well as a look ahead as too. And for that, we are turning to one of our regular contributors to Regionally Speaking, Morton Marcus, who is one of the premier Indiana economists who had run the economics team at Indiana University's Bloomington campus for many years. And he is with us now from someplace in the Hoosier State to bring us an update. Morton, thank you for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
It's a beautiful, bright Sunday Hoosier day.
That's right. We wish every day were like that. We know it isn't always possible, especially in the winter months, but we certainly would like to at least give the impression that it is. And as far as the sunnier things, too, we know the economy in Indiana can always be better. It's improved, but it still has its ups and downs. In fact, one of the recent columns that you had talked about Indiana's economic roller coaster. Give us an idea of your thoughts on that first.
Well, it's been that way for the past 40 years that I've been studying our economy. Indiana has good times, and it has bad times, and they're very steep in both directions. We go down deeply and more quickly than the rest of the country does, and when the economy is doing well, we, for a short time, will do better than the rest of the state. But the problem is that we always end up somewhat lower than the rest of the states do. We just don't keep pace with the nation, and that to me is a very serious matter. Keeping pace with the rest of the nation means just being mediocre, and it's even hard for Indiana to do that.
We know that we have fought very hard in the past, certainly a decade and even longer here, because, of course, the Great Recession kind of built on some of the problems that many sections of Indiana, including Northwest Indiana, have had to deal with here. With the change of the economy from the great industrial economy that we had to that of a service economy, and we're still seeing the problems that develop today. And you think that's some of the reason why Indiana's GDP is not keeping pace with its neighbors and other countries and other parts of the country?
Very definitely. The manufacturing part of our problem. We have a situation where manufacturing is a decreasing part of the American economy. It's a decreasing part of the world economy. The problems that we have in this country are very similar to the problems that they have in China, which is now one of the great manufacturing countries. But they are also having difficulties in terms of employment and the fact that the other sectors of the economy are growing more rapidly.
Are we finding, And you've really talked about this in one of your columns as well, about the fact that sections of Indiana are doing much, much better than others. We've talked about the issues here in Northwest Indiana, but giving us a look at some of the other regions of the state, where we find that the economy has picked up, and for what reasons do you see that that increase happening?
Oh, I think a large part of the difference between, say, Northwest Indiana and the central part of the state, the area in and around Indianapolis, is a matter of image. When you think of central Indiana, you're thinking of new buildings, you're thinking of active construction, you're thinking of a vibrant downtown. When you think of Northwest Indiana, there is no downtown. There is nothing that is central in Northwest Indiana. There is no specific leadership in Northwest Indiana. The fact that we have so many local governments, there are, I believe it's 11 cities and towns in Lake County. The number may be higher than that. So in a way, there's no identity. And as you drive along the interstates in Northwest Indiana, you don't get an image of progress. You see very few new buildings going up. You see a lot of old industrial buildings. Some of those have been taken down years ago, but they still remain. And if we've done some great work in restoring some of the land, for instance, along the toll road, there's been some wonderful recovery of that land for natural uses, but you just don't get that kind of feeling. And of course, there is the tremendous number of signs for the polite way of saying this, but places where young ladies display themselves quite a bit. All those signs along the interstate give you a very particular impression of Northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm. How many signs are there for fireworks as you drive along the Borman, for example?
Now you don't see as many of those signs about that you referred to before here as more you find more of them up here, it seems, than some places in Indianapolis area. But those places on the very south side. You have to go past 465 and some of the south side areas to see those signs, to be sure.
That's right. We just don't have the same kind of image of, and we don't seem to have any desire to improve that. There's nothing that is being done about that. It would be quite possible for Northwest Indiana communities to have a uniform billboard ordinance, there's no effort in that respect to do anything that's uniform. There's no desire to cooperate with each other. If there was a way to bring down the cost of government, local governments don't want to get together. And the citizens, and that's where it comes back to, the citizens of Highland and Munster and Griffin and such don't want to cooperate with each other. They're always concerned, well, you know, will the fire truck come to my house fast enough if we have a service that has two communities cooperating? This is just nonsense. The people of Northwest Indiana are the main problem that we have in Northwest Indiana. It's a refusal to cooperate with each other. It's an insistence upon having local governments that have no real reason for being. I know I get too excited about this, but it's just incredible to me that we still have any form of township government. We have 11 townships in Lake County. What is the reason for those township governments?
Let me ask you too, Martin, as we talk about cities and towns. I know that in one of your columns recently you talked about, it was in the southern part of the state actually, about I guess a reader from one of your columns asked you to offer up some solutions for the problems of smaller towns that were posed in a column. Do you think that there's maybe a link here? You talk about some of the improvements that can be made to towns and communities in other parts of the state. Do you think a lot of those can pertain to Northwest Indiana in particular.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There's no question about it. The issues that afflict Southern Indiana and the ones that afflict Northern Indiana are basically the same issues. We have problems with our schools. Schools that are allowing young people to leave before they can read and write and communicate. To me, that is so important. How can you possibly allow a person to leave school at age 16 or 17 if they cannot read and they cannot write and they cannot communicate? Communicate so that when they go in for a job interview, they're understood, that they're able to talk as though they have some degree of maturity. We find too many young people who can't read and write and communicate effectively. This isn't necessarily an immigrant population. This is also a native population, people who were born in this state who are unable to read and write and communicate. We've got other issues, and to me a large part of that is leadership. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to say who are the people that you go to in this community, generally wealthy people who can make things happen. But there are also politically astute people in communities that can make things happen. And too often, we don't have the names of those people. We don't know who they are, if they even exist. And I can, again, go back in memory, and there were people that you knew that if you went to see them, they could tell you how to get things done. They may not always agree with you. They may not support you. And if you go to them and look for money, they won't necessarily give it to you, but they'll tell you other people who can. These are what I call the go-to people. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard to find them. Financing your radio station is a very good example of this. How do you raise money for a radio station that's trying to serve the community? It's extraordinarily difficult to do those things. And in Northwest Indiana, there's very, very scattered leadership, if it exists at all.
You talked in a recent column here, Morton Marcus, about if you had Eric Holcomb's ear, what you would give as advice to him. You've talked about some of these things already, but what else would you bring up if you had a chance to sit down and talk with the incoming governor and actually got his attention? What might you bring up to him?
One of the things I would bring up is something that most people don't care about, and that is the transparency in the information that the state provides about its own functions. Let me just give you a simple example. What was the volume of retail trade in November in Lake County? And how did it compare with November a year ago? We don't have that information. But you do have that information if you live in Missouri. You can get county-by-county information every single month on retail sales tax collections. You can't get that in the state of Indiana. You can get it in Missouri. You can get it in Mississippi and in many other states. What about something as simple as the address of a business that's located in your community? You can't find that out from the state. You can find that out from some private sources, but the state considers everything confidential. Everything is confidential about a business, even the very fact that they're located. I'm sitting at the moment in the parking lot of a well-known restaurant. Mm-hmm. If you went to the state, you can't find out how many of these franchise restaurants exist in the state. You know, is that a secret? I can go out and see them. Why can't I find out about their existence from the state of Indiana? How many people today are working in on a city-by-city basis, on a zip code-by-zip code basis in Lake County? There's no necessary disclosure about any particular firm. I can get that information in detail once a year from the government of the state of Illinois. I can't get it from the government of the state of Indiana.
out.
So you think it's just this transparency that you're referring to, that's just something that that's a relic, I guess, of Indiana's past?
No, it's current. It's current because I've tried for my entire career to get this kind of information released. I was very concerned at one time about where we move hazardous materials. And I appeared before a state committee that was considering this question of how do we move hazardous materials through our communities. And they use census data. Well, census data doesn't tell you where people are in the daytime, it tells you where they are at night when they're home sleeping. So they use the census data, and that means that in the daytime, we move a lot of hazardous material to areas that are very well occupied because that's where people are working. But they're not there at night. And it just goes on and on. How many people, for example, in Northwest Indiana work downtown Chicago? We don't know. We know how many people are riding the South Shore, but we don't know how many people work in downtown Chicago and are not riding the South Shore because we don't have good origin destination information. How many people in Lake County, for example, are working right across the border in Will County? Will County is one of the fastest growing counties in the United States. Tremendous increase, not just in population, but in jobs. And a lot of those jobs may be going to people in Indiana. We don't know how many people are working in Will County from Lake County, except for the census information, which comes out so infrequently. These are the kinds of things that are important. If we're talking about increasing transportation to downtown Chicago, and the numbers of people working downtown Chicago from Indiana are actually decreasing, well, does this really make sense? We need to study these things, but to study these things, you have to have the information.
Mm-hmm. Well, Morton, we're going to have to leave it at that here. A great topic for the next time we talk, and especially bringing up about the point of people that live in Indiana and make the commute to Chicago. We know that the highways are very busy. We know that there are a lot of people that take the South Shore, and it'd be interesting to get more information about that. And it's a good point to bring up next time. I'll make a note of that, and hopefully we'll have a chance next time we talk to go into a bit more detail about that. We've been talking with Indiana economist Morton Marcus, who is also a speaker. He has a column that appears in media across Indiana as well, too, and occasionally we get him here on Regionally Speaking to tell us the latest and give us his view on these things. Morton, thank you very much for spending time with us today, and we'll be back with you soon, I hope.
Always my pleasure, sir.
Thank you.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. Thank you very much. Top fiscal lawmakers say that the potential impact of Donald Trump's proposed reforms could upend the new state budget that they will be writing early this next year. We find out more on that from Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith.
Budget-writing lawmakers received a new economic forecast earlier this month. That helps provide guidance as they determine how much money they can spend in the next 2-year state budget. But House Ways and Means Chair Tim Brown acknowledges that potential federal changes, something like altering the tax code or significant health care reform, could dramatically change the picture. And so he says House Republicans will put together a task force to monitor and evaluate federal legislation.
And I think we'd have time to analyze it and get back for a short session.
Senate Appropriations Chair Luke Kenley says he's especially watching for changes to the tax code, which he notes federal legislators seem eager to embrace.
So maybe that makes this economic forecast much more viable, even though it's a little rosier than I thought it was going to be.
A national analyst who provided an economic forecast to state lawmakers admitted he didn't include potential federal reforms in his outlook because they were too uncertain. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Sales of existing homes here in Northwest Indiana took a big jump in November, 40%, according to some figures from the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. And with us to talk about it, we have Valerie Rosenblum, who is the 2016 president of the GNIAR. Valerie, thanks for being with us. Tell us, if you will, why we seem to have such a big surge in home sales in November.
It's a big surge as compared to last year, because last year was a little bit slower. So this November is more comparable to the boom years in 2004 to 2006.
Give us an idea on the figures here. How many homes got sold here in the seven counties that make up the association?
for November, there were 9,125 units sold for a median selling price of $140,000. For November of 2016, there were 10,114 units sold with a median price of $147,500, which is a 5.4% increase in median price sale and a 10.8% increase in units sold.
Now, this kind of is just continuing the trend of a much stronger year than we have seen in just recent years, isn't it?
That is correct.
Well, we're not completely through the year. Of course, we have still December figures to put into the mix as well, too. But based on what we see right now, how does it shape up for 2016? How has the year of home sales been here in Northwest Indiana?
The year has been wonderful because up to this point, the interest rates have been down, and there's only been a shortage of inventory.
Mm-hmm.
It's a seller's market, and so the prices are going up. New home construction is still lagging a little bit. 2016 is far exceeding 2015 in the year-to-date, year-over-year comparisons.
That's great. That's great. You mentioned one thing, of course, inventory. There aren't as many homes that are out there to be sold as we have had in the past. Is that the big factor why we're seeing such the increase in sales when we do have them, as well as the median selling prices?
Yes, absolutely. Homes are selling in a much shorter time period for very close to their list price. If a home is priced correctly and is in moving condition, it sells very quickly within a very short time.
Mm-hmm, I see. Now, taking a look at the figures we have here from this year so far, how does it seem to trend, if we can do so, looking into what's coming up in 2017 now?
Well, there is still an inventory shortage, and projections are indicating that will continue into 2017. So it will still be a seller's market, and hopefully that the interest rates won't go up too high so that buyers will still be able to get as much for their dollar as possible, because we all know that once interest rates go up, they get less home for their dollar because they're paying more in interest.
Since you are a working realtor, can you give us just some examples of what you encounter out there in working with your clients and working with other realtors who have clients that are looking at homes that you happen to have on sale?
Well, I can tell you that my listings have been selling, as I say, very quickly. I can't keep them on the market long enough. For my buyers, we have a difficult time trying to find properties that meet their expectations because there are not that many available at this time. So we're hoping that there will be more listings coming on. Of course, this is winter months and the shortage is normal this time of year. I always tell my sellers this is a really good time to sell because you have less competition and the buyers out there are serious buyers, not out on a sunny summer day just looking at homes.
It's a big difference. That's true. You know, you've got to be pretty dedicated to be out there looking for something this time of year to be sure. As you've experienced it and your colleagues have experienced this as well, do you find still that we have a lot of people who are looking for their very first homes, but they're having trouble because of the fact that there are so few of them of that particular type out there?
Yes, absolutely. And we don't want them to settle for something they don't want. So what I counsel my buyers is, let's try and wait until the right home comes on the market. And what I do is I watch the market every day on our hot sheet, which gives us new listings and price changes and all. And as soon as something that comes on the market that seems to fit their needs, I try and get them to take a look at it immediately so that they have first chance on purchasing it.
One of the things I know that has been brought up in recent years here is because of the economy and the like, that it's difficult for many people to be able to either get the financing, of course, through a mortgage lender, to be able to buy a new home or buy the first home in many cases. Also, too, it's very difficult as well to come up with enough money saved back to be able to put down a decent down payment. Is this one of the reasons, or these one of the reasons, maybe I should say, that we find more people staying in rentals than going over into and buying their first home?
Well, we're seeing a lot more rentals, especially here in Porter County. We have some new properties that have come on the market just off of 49, and I can't recall at this moment what the name of it is, but mm-hmm. There are 400 rental units. And they're very high-end, so that if they're trying to attract a lot of people that were on the fence, whether should they buy or sell or just rent. And so that's attracting a lot of attention.
Are these the kind of people, perhaps, that, like you say, because they're more expensive to rent, that these folks here can make the payment every month for rental, and they're in turn, when the time comes, they can get into a decent home to get started?
Well, we hope so. Mm-hmm. We try to tell them, for the money that you're paying in rent, you could possibly buy a home and just, have better tax advantages. But sometimes there just is no, that's an obstacle, and they have to do that, whether it's because of their credit scores or what their debt-to-income ratio is. Sometimes renting is the only possibility for them at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Valerie, does it look like that kind of wrapping up this year that you mentioned it looks promising for 2017 as well? That pretty much the view of your colleagues with the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors.
Absolutely, absolutely. We are sure hoping that. But it's sure all the trends seem to be and all the projections indicate that will continue into 2017.
Valerie Rosenblum is the 2016 president of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. Valerie, thanks for your advice, some of the anecdotal points that you have as a working realtor out there, and some of the information in as we find a big surge from November of last year to November of this year in prices and sales of homes here in Northwest Indiana. Thanks for taking time to talk today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Funds are available out of Indianapolis to nonprofits all across Indiana in this year ahead on humanities-based programs. We're going to find out more about these Humanities Initiative grants from Indiana Humanities. We have George Hanlon, who's the Director of Grants for the Humanities Group. George, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. It's great to talk to you.
Well, thank you. It's a great opportunity to talk about an interesting program. Tell us how this particular grant program called the Humanities Initiative Grants, how did it get started?
Well, to be honest, I'm in my role about 6 months, and I don't know exactly how long we have been doing them. But I will say that, generally speaking, Indiana Humanities, we're celebrating our 45th year. I think in 2017 we'll be 45 years old, and we've been doing grants since the beginning. So we're a nonprofit organization headquartered in Indianapolis. We're a partner with the National Endowment for the Humanities, so we do get federal funding, and we turn around and take some of that money and redistribute it across the state. So since we were founded back in 1972, we have been a grant-making organization. Now, over the years, we've had a variety of different grants, and they've changed and evolved over the years. So exactly how long we have been giving out the Humanities Initiative grants, as we know them, I'm not quite sure, but we've been making grants for 45 years now.
Now, I should mention that the Humanities Initiative grants just one of the several grant programs that you've mentioned,
right,
George. A lot of other grants come out of the Indiana Humanities Organization go toward actual historic preservation education.
Right.
To tell people
right.
about the great history that the state of Indiana, which, of course, we're seeing and hearing now because it happens to be the bicentennial or 200th
sure.
birthday of the Hoosier State. But these things go on year-round, so it just doesn't happen during the bicentennial year.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, we do have this coming year four different grants, but the most common is the Humanities Initiative grant. That's sort of our catch-all that can be used broadly for a number of humanities-related topics. And when we say humanities, a lot of people have questions. What does that mean? So when we're talking about humanities, we're talking about history and literature and philosophy and languages. We don't cover, I should point out, we don't cover arts, visual and performing arts. We leave that to our friends at the National Endowment for the Arts and the Indiana Arts Commission to cover arts funding, but we do consider art theory and art history to be humanities. So we wouldn't fund, for example, an exhibit on Picasso, but if you brought a scholar in to talk about Picasso's role in the art world and his art movement, that would count. So, it's sometimes can be a little gray. So certainly if anybody out there who's listening wants to apply for a grant and they want some clarification, I'm always glad to talk and give some advice and guidance.
And I understand, too, that the Humanities Initiative grants can also include such things, besides having speakers come in, you have things like town hall meetings and workshops and the like, too. So it does cover
absolutely.
A pretty broad range of types
sure.
of topics like this, doesn't it? Yeah.
Sure, yes. Conversations, authors to come in, brochures, if you want to do a history of your town or walking tour of your town, we could cover brochures, publications. No, we don't. Who doesn't pay for the publication of books about topics that you would go and sell? But if you're putting together, for example, like a little booklet about your town or something, some element of your community that you wanted to promote, certainly people do that as well.
Let's talk about historic preservation education. It's very important, and there are some grants that are also available through the Indiana Humanities Organization.
Sure.
For that. Tell us about what those are. Those could be used for.
So, you know, the name pretty much says it all. It has to be used for historic preservation, the promotion of historic structures, and it has to be used for the education around those. So what these grants are not, they're not bricks and mortar grants. If you have an historic structure in your community and, you know, it needs some mortar work done or whatever, tuck pointing, it's not for that, but rather it is for materials or programs, again, workshops would be a good example to promote the history of those historic structures. And I should say, this is a grant that we fund in partnership with Indiana Landmarks, mm-hmm. which is a nonprofit here based in Indianapolis, but they have offices all across, including a wonderful Northwest regional office up in Miller Beach area. So we partner with them to distribute these grants. And again, it's just to educate the people about historic buildings or structures in your town. You know, and it can take even a little bit of side road away from even built things, such as cemeteries. For example, last year we gave a little community some money to do a cemetery restoration workshop. So, you know, it doesn't even have to be buildings, but generally speaking, it is about structures in your community that you want to educate your community about.
We're talking with George Hanlon, who is the Director of Grants for the Indiana Humanities Organization in Indianapolis, talking about the various grant programs for humanities-based programs. I know one of the other grant programs that you have set up here, besides the ones we've already talked about, is something called the In Common Grants. What's that all about? That's another collaborative, too, isn't it?
It is. Well, this is money that we got specifically from the National Endowment for the Humanities. We had to apply for it and receive special funding from them. We got $15,000 for the initiative. And the NEH is really concerned about, of course, the state of race relations, ethnic relations in the country. We've seen issues with police shootings and Black Lives Matters and, you know, ethnic profiling and such. And this grant is meant to address mm-hmm. some of those issues mm-hmm. through community conversations and dialogue, so we can talk about some of these challenges and perhaps, if not come to agreement about them, at least have some civil discourse that we can perhaps understand where the other side is coming from. So we got the money from the NEH. We are redistributing it across the state. People can apply for up to $5,000 to have these conversations in their community, and it can take a variety of forms. Again, you could, I know I've talked to some person who's going to apply, and they're going to hopefully bring an author in who wrote a book about the state of race relations in America, and bring that person in and maybe have a facilitator to lead a community conversation with them. It could be, you know, having some sort of workshop where you have panelists from different ethnic and racial backgrounds, talking about their perspectives and what it's like. So it can take a variety of formats, but the goal is to really have people in the community have conversations about these issues and, again, have some dialogue to promote some sort of understanding.
Now, if you'd like to find out more specific information about the grant programs, you can always go to the website www.indianahumanities.org and go to the grants page when you get to the homepage there. But give us a brief rundown here, George, on these various programs. Again, when the application deadlines are on these two. Go ahead.
Well, they vary. The one coming up most quickly is the In Common Grants, the race and ethnicity grants. That's due January 20th. We give two rounds of Humanities Initiative grants each year. We've got the first round, the deadline, coming up on January 30th, and then the second round is going to be July 31st. Mm-hmm. The Historic Preservation Education Grants, they actually require a prospectus, an initial statement of what you want to do, so we can kind of read through it and call you back and give you some advice on that. That's due, I think, February 17th, and then the full proposal will be due in April. Our website, indianahumanities.org, if you go to the grants page, you can read about all the grants that we have to offer, and they're very specific with guidelines and application deadlines and things like that.
We've been talking with George Hanlon, who is the Director of Grants for the Indiana Humanities. Again, if you're interested in checking out the grant programs that the organization offers, you can go to the website, www.indianahumanities.org, and you can find out more about the organization there, too, as well as the grant programs that are available. George, thanks for the information, and we're passing the information on. We hope that more folks are involved in setting up town hall meetings, discussions, and speeches and the like, and if they're to the topics that the grant program can help out. It's certainly worth the time to apply for these. Thank you very much for the update. We will be checking back with you again soon.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to hear from you.
Kyle Meredith had a chance to talk with the Trash Can Sinatras about their newest album, Wild Pendulum, which Kyle says is in his top 10 of 2016. Here's Kyle with the Trash Can Sinatras on The Speed of Sound.
The Speed of Sound with Kyle Meredith.
One of the most criminally overlooked bands of the past few decades is Trash Can Sinatras. While they may have slipped past the mainstream, their devout following has kept them creating excellent songs that make excellent albums. And I don't mind saying that their newest, Wild Pendulum, is their best yet. In fact, it's in my top 10 of the year. I'm Kyle Meredith at The Speed of Sound.
Let me in.
I'd like to start by telling you how big of a fan I am of this new record, Wild Pendulum.
We like it too, yeah.
I hope so. Yeah.
It's not always the case of fans of records, you know, like so much. I'm sure you can imagine just the making of it. And the people making it, you remember on every nook and cranny of it.
And you worked with Mike Mogus as the producer on this.
That's right, yeah. Up in the bright eyes. Oh, he's wonderful.
Did you guys go into the album with that in mind, that you wanted a very specific sort of person behind the boards?
What had happened was that we knew we needed somebody. The demos that we had were really quite chaotic. So we knew we needed somebody with like fresh authority who could come in and say, first of all, that who got what we were doing. And Mike really won me over as soon as I met him. He just said, this stuff sounds daft, it sounds crazy, but it sounds like it'll be fun to make. I want to help you guys build this. I can hear what you're trying to do. You know, he knew he had a perspective on what we were trying to do and where it should go. We, I think, were too close to do that successfully, I think.
Don't come around me no more.
What's such a unique sounding album. The songs, you know, these beautiful movements that happen throughout them, you know, I don't think Rare is a song on it what I would call formulaic, you know. And in fact, one of the only ones that instantly jumps out that I know has got a lot of attention is All Night, which ends up possibly being the poppiest thing you've ever written.
I always liked the fact that with the records when I was growing up that I liked, being a big kind of chart fiend, you couldn't really hear guitars. You weren't really aware of guitars. Maybe drums you were, but instruments didn't really poke out. It was just a kind of sonic pop thing that slapped you in the face. And we really wanted to get something quite like that, I think, you know, something that was a little bit chaotic, but it just had a sheen to it. You couldn't really precisely hear what everything was doing, you know.
And there's a nice, of course, challenge to me where it says, come on, DJ, earn your money. I'm like, I can't not play this now without feeling like I have to live up to something, which, you know, that's fine. I'll take it.
We weren't really thinking of radio DJs at the time, but yeah. I suppose you guys are in there too, right?
Come on, DJ.
I'm sure you've got to probably get tired of the time question, because people make a very big deal of the gap between your all's albums. Is that ever concerning to you? That, you know, you've got to be like, I'm not on the 2-year cycle, so what?
Oh, no, it's not a concern at all. No, I mean, it's the only thing that matters is the music being good enough, and it's a combination of just the time it takes us to work by committee. Everybody needs to sign off. There's four equally kind of strong songwriting voices there that need to be not only heard with their ideas, but we still operate in the understanding that we all have to love what we're doing. So that just takes a while. You know, it took us a while to get 12 songs that reached everybody was happy with. I mean, it came up with like 14 eventually, but out of a good, you know, 25. When with the kind of gaps that we leave, you do, you know, the devil finds work for those hands, you know, and you, the doubt creeps in, and so you're always, you know, you're doubting your creativity as if it would ever disappear, you know.
Right.
You're under that. You're under the illusion that you're not a creative person.
Are you able to say, like, this is what I can expect a successful record for us to do?
Yes, even since just that last album, I think everything's changed so much, because even within the music in 2008 or so, the crowdfunding thing just seemed a little bit cheeky.
Yeah.
But the difference now, when it's become like an absolute like standard,
yeah.
And as things head down kind of the streaming path, hopefully, you know, like with the help of like, you know, the Musicians Union in Britain, I don't know what it is over here, the ASCAP or something, but whoever's fighting for artist royalty rates, which are, you know, scandalous just now. I mean, they need to be sorted, because that's the way it's going to go. It's going to be all streaming. I don't know. I mean, it's frightening in a way to think of what it's going to be like when our generation has stopped making music or has died, and it's just only people that only know this stuff, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of frightening to think it can go either way. So right now there's still people alive fighting for it, because they know it's a different, there was a different way, you know.
Yeah, if it's not too much inside baseball, you know, a band at your level, how do you survive? Like, where does the survival come from? The revenue or whatever it is?
Well, it wouldn't happen without Pledge, etc. Like, fundraising, we wouldn't have made a record. And without really, like, without getting too kind of, like, spice rack about it, you know, my wife and I, she does most of the earning, and, you know, like, we, for us, we've got understanding spouses that way, you know. It's just, we keep a little bit coming in from our royalties, but, you know, it'd be a different scene if we were to get kicked out of our houses, that's for sure.
Wild Pendulum is the newest from Trash Can Sinatra's, and I couldn't recommend it more. Oh, wait, yes, I can, by saying it one more time. It's great! For more of my interviews, head to Facebook and Twitter at Kyle Meredith. Thanks to Chris Allman for co-producing and editing this episode. And from the studios of WFPK in Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Kyle Meredith at The Speed of Sound.
Speed of Sound with Kyle Meredith can be heard here on Regionally Speaking on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And you can also check out podcasts of the program as well online on our website, lakeshorepublicmedia.org. Just go to music on the radio page and find out more about The Speed of Sound. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, we will bring you, among other things, a conversation with Steve Coxett with the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance. We hope you'll join us for that.